Hey there, and welcome to another episode of Analytics Neat. I'm your host, Bill Bruno. For those of you that might be new here, Analytics Neat is a weekly podcast. It comes out every Monday. I tend to cover media, marketing, analytics, technology, and data, and I do it in a short format to try to make it something easy for you to digest and then move on with your day. I also love interacting with all of you, so you can reach out to me directly on Twitter, at Bill Bruno, using the hashtag AnalyticsNeat. You can also give the podcast a follow, at AnalyticsNeat on Twitter as well. So if you have any ideas, topics, questions, concerns, hit me up, and I'd love to chat. And whether you're an avid listener of the podcast or you're new here and you like what you happen to be hearing, then please rate, review, and subscribe on whatever platform you prefer. If I'm not on a platform that you prefer to listen to, let me know and we'll try to figure that one out too. All right, so welcome back. Let's go ahead and get started with the undercard this week. We'll start off with Cyber Monday, the largest online shopping day of the year, which this year in the US ended up being the largest online shopping day in history. There was just under $10 billion in spend total on that day, with a lot of it a bit last minute, later in the day, and it was almost 20% higher than the previous year. Here's the kicker, though, and it's going to start to develop into a bit of a theme, but over $3 billion was spent on mobile devices that day, and it's the largest ever for mobile. And from what I saw on some of my most favored brands and some of the emails I was getting, the sales on Monday were actually better than many of the sales on Friday. So from my perspective, taking that a step further, I actually ended up making 6 purchases over the weekend. Some of them were Christmas gifts for family and friends. 4 of those purchases were on mobile. And in the mobile cases, only one of them was subpar in my opinion. The other 3 had actual mobile apps that I could use that I have already installed on my phone. And really, they all should at this point to optimize the experience. And on that same vein, if you're a clothing company or where there's items where I should be able to keep track of the sizes that I've purchased just in case it's been a little while, or I want to go back and see, you know, how did this one shirt that I bought fit, go take a look at the Bonobos app. It's one of my favorite brands, but they build a closet within their app for you. They keep track of their sizes. They keep it simple. And honestly, when you're looking to optimize a mobile app, you should be looking at your competition like this and realizing what works and what doesn't and what people like. That was the biggest thing that I learned over the course of this past shopping weekend in the US and all of the different sales, was just how much variance there is in usability across so many websites and how many retailers are still falling so far behind the game. And it's pretty ridiculous, actually, and unexplainable in this world that we live in today, especially given how driven it is by mobile. So if there were any failures out there in terms of, you know, brands that didn't hit their numbers, go take a look at their usability first, because I would guarantee you that that probably has something to do with it. So switching gears, I spent this past week doing a variety of webinars launching version 9.1 of Celebrus, the data capture platform from D4T4 Solutions. And there were some pretty amazing features that I think are important to at least raise. I'm not making this a sales pitch. I just think these are things that other digital marketing technology vendors struggle with. And so I wanted to raise sort of the 4 key features from that, just as things to keep top of mind as you're looking to build your data management strategy or your data capture strategy across your organization. One is Google Accelerated Mobile Pages. Celebrus has now launched not only the most in-depth and granular data capture from those pages, but it's also come up with a way, because of our patented technology, to stitch those sessions together. So instead of having somebody viewing an AMP page and then a non-AMP page on your website, and that being 2 separate sessions, it will be 1 joined up session at an individual level. We also reinforce the fact that Celebrus is completely unimpacted by any of the browser changes with regards to cookies, as well as Apple's launch of the ITP protocols. We enhanced an API so that you can now capture data from any non-standard application that you want and still make use of the same data model that's part of the IP of Celebrus that allows you to instantly stitch together the individual within milliseconds. And then finally, we offered up something that we're calling legitimate interest. And I think this is a massive challenge in the industry that folks need to be aware of with regards to digital fraud. The long story short is, because of GDPR, CCPA, and others, when you opt out of tracking, fraudsters realize that that also makes it a lot more difficult to identify that what they're doing is fraudulent activity because it limits the amount of data that's captured. Well, there's a loophole there from a GDPR perspective that says that you can capture uninhibited, unfiltered data about visits as long as you're keeping it separate from marketing and you're only using it for use cases such as fraud detection. And Celebrus is the only marketing technology in the industry today that allows you to not only capture marketing data as granular as we do, but also then capture a separate data stream specific to fraud without any tagging, without any adjustments, so on and so forth. It's an incredible launch for us, very excited about it. And it was a very long but exciting week sort of launching those features, meeting with the analyst community, so on and so forth. So that brings us to the final topic of the undercard today. I honestly could not let this episode go by without discussing all of the uproar around the Peloton advertisement. There's been a lot of blowback on this one. There's been a reply from Peloton that kind of towed the company line. And then there was a humorous aviation gin ad from Ryan Reynolds, who we all know and love as Deadpool, where he brought the same female actor from the commercial and had sort of a follow-up to that. Now, from my perspective, I'm not really sure why this commercial was such a big deal. I watched the commercial. Maybe I'm biased because I'm an avid user of the bike. But it seemed like people jumped all over this based upon how they perceive the situation of getting the bike as a gift or buying the bike or, you know, she's already fit. Why does she need a bike? So on and so forth. You know, from my perspective, I totally got it because I felt very similarly to that journey. I was terrified of the bike at first and just cycling classes in general. And now I love it. It plays a key role in keeping me centered from week to week. You know, I consider myself quite fit, but I still have the bike because I think it's just an extra, it's a different level of exercise. And for me, as I'm getting older and you start to become aware of things like cholesterol, you realize that cardio workouts and strong cardio workouts are something that goes a long way to helping for that. But I think what we're seeing here in terms of the reaction to the ad, because you had the supporters, you had the detractors, you had the people in the middle like myself who really just didn't care. But, you know, overall, this really got me thinking about advertising in general and just how difficult it is. Because from where I'm sitting, if you're trying to be creative and do something different or maybe try to present a message these days, you're going to have haters and you're going to have people who love it. There's just no way around it. It almost promotes, you know, society today being boring for the masses and having kind of the general message just be something very benign. And then leveraging personalization for one-to-one focused messages when you figured out what type of persona you're dealing with, right? I think it's a very interesting dynamic in that regard when you think about it that way and you think about advertising personalization from the perspective of what we've covered on the podcast over the last couple of years. And the society we live in today and that so-called, although I hate it, that cancel culture is just waiting to jump all over a brand for something viewed as off-putting. And there's definitely been brands that have overstepped and have gone too far and deserve all of the hate that they've gotten. But then when you watch an ad like the Peloton ad, which honestly I think leaves it up for interpretation, and I know that there was making fun of facial expressions. If you haven't ridden the bike or done a cycle class, I can't even imagine what my face looks like when I'm in the middle of those classes and how distraught I probably look because they kick the crap out of you. But perhaps this is where advertising targeting can be of assistance. It's an interesting world because I feel like there's always been like this creative drive to try to come up with something special that captures what your brand values are and so on and so forth. And not everybody's going to get that. Not everybody's going to care. And not everybody's in your target market either. So this is where I think the power of personalization and truly getting better at one-to-one or one-to-many from a persona perspective, leveraging first-party data to get to know who your average customers are, who your potential demographics and customers are, and fine-tuning where those messages are seen and heard is really important, I think, to try to limit the amount of blowback to responses. And I'm overgeneralizing a bit, but I wanted to weave this together with advertising analytics and just the struggle in that industry in general. And listen, Peloton, this is now just you and me. I know you're probably an avid listener of Analytics Neat. You could have probably come up with a much cooler commercial in hindsight where you had a various sets of couples from all different background demographics and genders gifting to their significant others and having their significant others becoming friends on the Peloton app and high-fiving each other during the classes and show that community aspect of it, because I think that's the part that's most uplifting. So that's just some free advice for you for the next commercial. You're welcome. All right, so that was a bit of a long-winded undercard, I think, but we'll go ahead and jump into the main event. We want to look at AB InBev and their media brief because they were in the news this week for all the wrong reasons. Lindsay Stein, a friend of mine from my Ubiquity days at Campaign, published an article about an upcoming global media review that the brand is undergoing. Now I want to take a step back here and level set because I have had teams of mine working with AB InBev on many occasions over the years. They've been a very demanding brand, and they also have historically been quite frugal with negotiations, regardless of the perceived value that they'd be getting from whatever the services are. They also make it quite difficult to enjoy working with them, which causes a lot of churn on the consulting side. And I think there's, you know, a point to be made here that the most demanding, the least fulfilling clients tend to cause a lot of burnout on teams as well. And so why is that important? Well, it's a lack of consistency. It's across the team. It's inability to build a strong understanding of the brand across that team. And, you know, at the end of the day, when it comes to media buying, because there's so many nuances to that, if there's a lack of consistency and you got people swapping in and out, that's going to cause a problem. It's going to cause some unhappiness probably with the quality of work. And then you find yourselves in a media review. And I think it's worth also mentioning that during my time at Ubiquity, I participated in or managed directly many pitches that we had done, particularly led out of the US for some of our largest brands. So I've got a lot of data to use as a point of comparison while reading through this article that Lindsay posted. So I'll use that background and try to explain the issues. So what is their media review in the first place? Well, the RFP document that landed in the hands at Campaign stated, and I quote, that we are seeking to confirm an optimal 2021 plus media structure and agency roster that will be able to deliver best-in-class capabilities and MarTech integration, strategic and operational excellence, and strong commercial value, end quote. So that sounds somewhat normal, right? I'll tell you that that statement I've read on many briefs. It's not all that innovative. Although you'll also notice that commercials is emphasized in that statement, and that there's not really anything about data-driven, you know, overcoming third-party and first-party data challenges in advertising, better measurement of results, so on and so forth. I mean, best-in-class capabilities is a pre-built statement that goes into these briefings. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's what the focus is. It's kind of like a Mad Lib, right? And perhaps there's more of this in the brief, but in my experience, most media pitches are done to try and cut costs, which really should not be the main driver. You want to ensure that you're paying a fair market rate, absolutely. But I always hated when the brands solely emphasize costs, but yet want the world for it, right? Instead of that whole you get what you pay for philosophy, they're expecting that to be different in this case. And I think that's a really difficult position to be in, not just from a brand perspective, who's trying to achieve results, but also from the partner who happens to win the brief and has to try to deliver on that. And it really is a poor mantra, right? The quote-unquote, we want to pay you X percent less, but we want your best team and ideas. But back to the pitch. There's really two elements that come out in the brief that automatically kind of hit you in the face as not great. One is payment terms. They're trying to expand the payment terms or the time between payments of 150 days. That's 5 months of work without payment. For a media account, that can be massive, especially the size of AB InBev. And that's not a small ask, and especially when you also want the best team that you can get. It really does put the organizations in a bind. Maybe not the largest agencies who have bankrolls, but let's be honest, it hasn't been that great of a environment for agencies these days either, so it's not like they're just rolling around in money. And it's not nearly a best practice. And from an accounting perspective, from a CFO perspective, that is a real pain to carry those debts on the balance sheets for over 5 months, assuming that they even pay on time in the first place. The other part that came up, and I'm just going to quote this directly from the Campaign article, is, quote, the pitch will require agencies to guarantee future media buying guarantees by participating in an online reverse auction, which makes agencies undercut each other to unrealistic prices, end quote. And that came from a consultant familiar with the brief that Campaign interviewed. Now, have you ever done an auction RFP as an example? They are legitimately the worst. It's the opposite of an eBay auction where everybody's raising the price. Instead, you're coming in at a lower price. You're in this anonymous community. Somebody puts in their number, and then you have a chance to come in at a lower number. And so that's just a horrible way to go through business, because you're really just looking to undercut people. And there's no, I mean, the guarantees are minimal at best. You're saying, yeah, we can hit this number. But then what's going to happen downstream is they're going to say, oh, it's only for these specific types of buys, and you've asked for a specialty buy. We can't hit that number. And that's how these relationships fall off the wheels in the first place, when you build a relationship built on a fractured foundation like this. I mean, this is not going to go well for AB InBev. It wouldn't go well for any brand to do this. But taking a step away from the specific approach of AB InBev, why are pitches helpful, and when should you do one? Here's the first thing I want to lead off with, and this is the part that's usually forgotten from my experience. It's that you should do some pre-work before you even consider going out to pitch. So one is, you know, kind of thinking through and confirming with your teams that the existing relationship with your agency isn't salvageable. What are the challenges? What are the issues? What's the frustration? You know, has it something that's been built up over time? Is it, you know, something that you can repair? You know, the incumbent typically always participates in a pitch. But honestly, you shouldn't need a pitch to fix that relationship. So if you're going out to pitch just to scare your partner into providing you some sort of cost reduction, you're probably not thinking about this correctly. Now, if you're going out to pitch because you're struggling with transparency and you want to see who's going to offer you the best possible level of transparency because of all the issues that are rife across the digital and traditional ecosystem with rebates and otherwise, then yeah, absolutely, that might make sense. But in other situations, I think it's best to first try to sort it out directly with the agency. And then if you can't, then look elsewhere and manage a pitch then that doesn't include the incumbent. You know, there's really no reason for it if you think it's completely irreparable. So I think pitches then can be helpful. It can be helpful because your brand changes, your needs are changing. You know, things can sometimes get stale. Maybe the team's just been there too long. They're too close to the trees, right? You could get a new team, you could get some new thinking, you could get potentially better processes and technology, you maybe will get more innovation or a different structure of the team that fits more with where you're trying to take your organization. Maybe you'll come across better approaches to data, maybe you'll find that more transparency that I mentioned before. And I would say of all of that, transparency and measured results are probably the two most important things, in my opinion, that need to be a focal point if you're going through a media review of any kind. Right after that, I would say protected first-party data approach layers into that. You know, how are we going to limit and lower our reliance on third-party data? How are we going to secure and protect my first-party data as a brand and ensure that it's not getting added to some other pools for you to then sell and use elsewhere? And I think this brings me to a point that, you know, comes from my past as well, but, you know, benchmarking and auditing firms try to make a ton of money on establishing marketplace costs. But the reality is that the data isn't all that great in the first place for those comparisons in most situations. And it's even worse when it comes to digital, which is where most of the investment is going anyways, especially when you think of just digital TV, streaming TV, connected TV, however you want to refer to it. And I saw this firsthand in my prior roles. What you really want to do with the costs is ensure that you're getting a fair shake. And honestly, that's pretty easy to do with comparisons to what you pay today, what's published out in the marketplace. And if you're going to use an auditor for anything, I would focus on financial compliance and transparency for that. Benchmarking spots isn't really going to move the needle anymore. It's an antiquated model, and it's a model that just frankly has not graduated to accommodate the environment that we live in today and the way that advertising is consumed in the marketplace. And I personally think if you are going to do any kind of benchmarking and auditing, then your best results are just doing year-on-year comparisons of your own buys and simply looking for inefficiencies tied to measured results, while also using some of the marketplace benchmarks that are published and available out there that you can get from the analyst community and otherwise. But I'm going to go ahead and wrap this week's episode of Analytics Need up right then and there. Hopefully that gives you some food for thought and helps put some of the media reviews into perspective. We'll be back again next week with another new episode. And until then, I hope you have a great rest of your week. Please, if you do have a few moments, rate, review, and subscribe. Share with your friends. The ratings do really help. And please feel free to continue to submit those questions as well. Thank you so much.